Thanks. and thanks again to the organizers for inviting me. It's a lovely place to be. What I'm going to talk about is genetic association studies in the presence of structure and admixture. And this topic has been discussed quite a bit, maybe in the last 10, 15 years. This work is with a graduate student of mine, Nick Pajewski, at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And I'll begin with some genetics background. Now, I must say something. Nick's the one that knows that part, and I'm just learning from him.
You're the
so I'm the graduate student in that part. So, but at any rate, I've been on the other side where I sit in an audience and there's some genetics talk, and you know, first 3 minutes I think I understand what's going on, and then all of a sudden there's a barrage of terms thrown out at me, and I have no idea what's going on anymore. And so the language just gets away. So hopefully I'll be able to say something very simple, and many of you who know much more about it will find that kind of maybe even silly, because I'll have simplified it to just fit today's purpose, okay? And so let's see how that goes. And then I'm going to talk about impact of structure on association studies. So I'll clear. Here we go again. So I got to talk about what association studies are and what is the structure business. So hopefully I'll be able to do that. Then I'll say some remedies are in the literature, and then of course what else but a DPM is what we got to do here, and then I'll show you some clustering and estimation success. This is going to be via simulation and sort of anecdotal, but at least in the ballpark of where I think the geneticists want it to be in terms of sample sizes and marker locations and all this kind of stuff that they talk about. So, there are no proofs here at all. So then a model for admixture. Now here's another word. So I'll say something about what that is and how it causes some extra trouble. And then perhaps I don't know exactly what to do about it, but there is some model for it, and I'd like your reactions to that. So here's the genetics terminology bit. Okay, so chromosomes come in pairs. This is called homologous pairs. And a chromosome is just a long DNA molecule. And it has these letters for my purposes, just okay? And that's all, they're base pairs or something like that. But okay, and then what is a gene? A gene is sort of a section of it, contiguous section. It could be have lots of letters, few letters, or depending on the biological context. That's how I understand it. And then there is a locus or polymorphism. So these genes are located at a particular place on the chromosome. And so that's when we say locus, it could refer to that one single letter, or it could refer to a section of it that is biologically meaningful for the study that is being conducted. So that word locus doesn't mean one spot here. This was my misconception when I first started out. It's, oh, locus. No, it's not how it is. So a gene is a section, as I said. And what's an allele? Well, genes come in varieties. And so different varieties of the gene are called alleles. And a genotype is, and a gene is the same gene. That's why they call homologous, these chromosomes. So what is here is the same gene as here, but perhaps a different variant of it. Okay? So that's how these genotypes are made up. Genotypes are a combination of these two. So for the purpose of notation, you can talk about something present and absent, and then it would be a cap A and a little a. And so you can have a cap A, little a, cap A, or cap A, little a. Sometimes this distinction is made, sometimes not, and little a. I will not have data to make that distinction. So we'll just know whether it's heterozygous, that's what this is, or homozygous. And then the word phenotype simply means, what is it that you're interested in measuring on the human being or the person? So it could be a continuous measurement, like blood pressure. It would be a phenotype of interest. Or it could be a disease that's present or absent. So it could be a binary measurement. So that's a phenotype. So please, those of you who know, correct me if I said something wrong so I don't mislead everybody. Okay. So now, a little bit, just a very little bit, about propagation, inheritance, and diversity. So what we're really going to look at here, these association studies, just look for, is there an association between a certain allele at a certain locus and the disease or the phenotype? So if you can just go out and randomly collect people and genotype them at the locations of interest, and then see if it is associated with what your phenotype is. But the trouble with that is that the populations aren't homogeneous. So therefore, there are people come from different subpopulations, human subpopulations. And that has real implication on these association studies. So actually, I'm not so sure that all of this overhead here is really that important. What is important is, even if you began with some common ancestry, over generations, that's going to diversify. And then this morning's one talked about all sorts of Bayesian nonparametrics models to describe that diffusion. At least that's how I took that. I forget the name. The second half-hour talk. Yes. But what is important here for me is to see that even if you begin with something, you will diversify in the allele frequencies. So what are the allele frequencies? If your sample is not coming from a population that's homogeneous, then you're going to have trouble. So often people talk about two kinds of independence. Independence of the allele from chromosome to chromosome, the homologous pair, and that would be the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. And linkage disequilibrium would be not independence from locus to locus. Okay? So that's so locus to locus means along the molecule, along the chromosome. All right. So I'm going to make some very simplifying assumptions to begin with. And later on, you can go and do some fancier stuff. So what we want to do is we want to create, because by simulation mechanism, these populations that are diverse and that are sort of meaningful for that simulation process to the people that work in genetics. So they use this thing called FST, which is Wright's measure of divergence. Actually, its definition and all of that is not what I'm giving here. I'm just giving you a mechanism that I thought was simple for me to understand, because how I'm going to simulate these things. Okay? So basically, that FST, you make this ratio, 1 minus FST or FST. You start with some ancestral allele frequency. And this could be fixed, or you could maybe, for our purposes, we didn't have real data, so we were just randomly simulating from a uniform on 0.1 to 0.9, so we didn't get real low and high frequency alleles. And then what you do, and that's call that P, and then pi is the allele frequency for the population after the diversity has happened. And so the way that goes is it's just a beta random variable with these parameters, which makes the expectation P, and the variance is P1 minus P times the F. That's the Wright's measure of diversity. And so if you do that, then of course, if this is zero, then this variance is zero, so nothing has happened, it's fixed. So actually, it's called fixation index. And I don't know exactly what the origin of that is. But if nothing changes, then that P would remain a P. But if FST is non-zero, then it'll have some variance. Okay? And so we're going to do that. We're going to use this sort of simulation as I talk some more about it. Study design. So we want to study the association of an allele type or genotype and some phenotype, which may be a binary or continuous. So you can have quantitative or binary. We talked about that. And sampling design can be cross-sectional or case-control. So cross-sectional means you're just sampling randomly from the population, and some people have the trait, some don't have the trait, or if it's a quantitative one, well, you have a number for everybody, you measure that, and then you genotype these people. So, but if you have, but that's often not practical. So we go to case control studies. So it's easier to identify people with a disease and then get a random sample of people without the disease and then genotype both of those samples at all the markers that are of interest, or the loci. See, here I go again. I say marker and loci, locus. Well, it's all the same to me. Okay. Correct me as I've given you the chance. So it's really a 2x2 table with column totals fixed, and that's simple analysis. So straightforward analysis, traditional analysis, are just linear models and contingency tables, and you know, even the frequentists can do fine with that. Okay, but the population structure is what is going to really cause us trouble, because what you have here is that the allele frequencies are not the same, and you don't know what population each individual came from. So it's like an important missing variable. So if you, in your sample, you're going to get people from everywhere. It's a cross-sectional sample. And even if it's case control, you're still sampling controls from all of the people that are available. And so therefore, it's not clear that would be, in almost all genetic studies, this is a problem. And so you won't know which population, what allele frequencies they were in the population from which the person in your sample came, okay? And so that's what is called structure. So the population is not homogeneous. It has these distinct clusters. And also, there is admixture. Now, admixture, I'll say a little bit more when I talk about how we're simulating this. But admixture is, you can think of it as there are these separate population groups, and then there are offsprings of parents from two different groups. And doesn't have to be right at the parent level. It could be older ancestry also. So you would have different levels of admixture. Okay? And invariably, in almost all modern human populations, you're going to see both, is structure and admixture. So and then you can see how this is probably simple for statisticians to understand right away that this is going to be very misleading in calculating any associations. So in the genetics literature, there are some of these references, mainly here for the references to say that this has been discussed heavily, and some people still argue whether that is something you should worry about or is it small enough that we can ignore it, etc. But from the statistical viewpoint, I just don't see how you can ignore it. And I'll show you at least a simulation case where it's terrible. Okay, and it can go in either direction, meaning you can either have spurious correlation, or you can have an attenuation of the correlation. It's masked. And so so this needs to be addressed. So to address this, over the last, let's see, it's 93, I think the sort of, in my other references, the genetic references that I gave you, I think it's maybe 88 is the first one where it was pointed out that this could be a serious problem. And so after that, people started thinking about things, how to not get into this trouble. So Spielman and co-authors then developed this transmission disequilibrium test. So it really doesn't take a sample in the way it needs parental information, okay? So what they do is you have cases and you have controls, and you're not going to just associate with what that allele type is. Let's say the one you're focused on is little a cap a, okay? Now if both parents, if you have their genotypes for both parents, and they were both little a little a's, then you could never be a little a cap a. So in that case, those people are not useful. So those are taken out of the sample. And so you restrict yourself to only those that show transmission of this gene. And among them you compare how many. So actually it's case control. So among the ones that have the disease, you see how many show transmission. And among those that don't have the disease, you see how many show transmission. And if there is a differential in that transmission, then you have evidence of association. Okay? But now this requires genotyping parents, which especially in late onset diseases is just not possible because they've often passed away. So there are some limitations to that. Sample size also is a concern because many of these pairs are not informative. So the parent pair is not informative to determine transmission. And so you lose some sample size there also. But although it has been used. Now, this genomic control of Devlin and Rader of 1999 is a very clever thing. So now what we're going to do is we're going to have some loci that will be called null markers. The null markers are the ones that you're confident don't affect the disease. They're just totally on an unrelated chromosome or something like that where you don't really, but have information about ancestry, supposedly. So you have these null markers, and then you have, let's say, one candidate locus. Candidate locus is the one that you're interested in determining the association for. And so what they do is they say, okay, well, this, and typically it's a chi-square test. If you just do a frequentist test, it's going to be a chi-square test at that candidate locus. But that chi-square, you know, is either inflated or deflated by this structure, population structure that I described. So they just model that as some scaled version of a chi-square, okay? And then say, where is the information for that scale? Where are you going to get it from? Well, they're going to go to the null markers and calculate all those chi-squares, and that's going to give them information about how these are inflating or deflating. And then they have a sort of a clever, nice model to say, it's a Bayesian outlier model or a latent outlier model, whatever you want to call it. And then they end up eventually adjusting the p-value of the chi-square at the candidate locus. Okay? So that is the sort of approach that they took in this genomic control. Pritchard and co-authors in several papers, the first two papers are in 2000, but there's several after that, and I'll maybe say something about one or two of them. This is my term, and it's a modeled classification is what he's going to do. So he's going to take the data again at null markers and the candidate loci, and then combine them all and see if it is possible to do classification, and then proceed with inference from there. And I'll describe his method a little bit more in detail. Structural association is somewhat similar to this approach, but it relies only on the likelihood and doesn't use Bayesian methods and also needs a rare disease assumption. So probably won't say very much about that. Modeled classification approach of Pritchard's basically is going to, let's consider the cases and control situation, okay, for this case, because that's where they first developed it, although they have other situations too now. So this is some notation. So Zi is the population pointer. So it can be between 1 and k. Cap k is fixed. So it says, okay, there are 7 populations here, or 4 populations. And then each person has a population pointer. There are genotypes at all of these L plus 1. This is one candidate locus, which is the first one. And then 2 to L plus 1 are the null markers. And then you have genotype frequencies at each one of those. For the kth population, Lth locus, and J is 1, 2, 3. So that's the three genotypes that we're considering. Little a, cap a, cap a, cap a. Okay? And then there are these admixture proportions, because each individual could be possibly admixed. So that just goes over K. And this is just shorthand for all of these, Z, X, P, because that's how I'm going to simply write the likelihood here. So basically what he does is he just models this. This is all parametric modeling as this. Now, what I have done here, I put a slash here. This is really not. I mean, people are either put in a population or they're admixed, okay? So it's not both. It's one or the other. But some people may be classified and some people may be judged as admixed. And so there is a joint inference there. And X. So basically, he's going to get a posterior distribution for this admixture or population assignment, and going to also get the frequencies for that population. For each population at each locus, the frequencies are going to be estimated. And that inference is Bayesian, okay? With some very mild non-informative priors. And then after that comes the phenotype to see if now that we have this information, is it related, the candidate locus, is it related to the phenotype? That's what what they're going to do. And how do they do that? Well, they just make this likelihood ratio, okay? And so they're writing this. So the probability, the X is all the genotype information that you have. And this here is under the null hypothesis. And under the null hypothesis, there is no association. So they don't depend on the phenotype at all. And you just collect them up this way for the ith individual. And of course, there's a product in here to get to the denominator of this lambda. And that's the first term. And for the second term, it is just if you have the genotype or not have the genotype, that decides whether that gets added in or not, okay, with the correct Q. Now, the correct Qs, he only uses the means. So only the point estimates, Bayesian point estimates, are used and not the uncertainty. So it's kind of like a two-stage thing where they do the first stage and then take the answers from it and plug in into this method and then maximum likelihood through EM algorithm. Okay, and the significance levels are approximated through simulation. So that was their method. Now it's been extended in many different ways, and so linkage disequilibrium and correlated allele frequencies. This paper here, Zhang et al. Goes a more proper Bayesian approach here with the model uncertainty that was for K. Oh, by the way, I didn't say that. Pritchard's method he tries different Ks and then selects a K based on something like an AIC or BIC or some criterion like that. So criterion-based selection of K, and then he fixes that and then does all the other calculations. So they changed that and properly accounted for the model uncertainty for K. And then there are many of these other, here's a Bayesian approach, Hoggart's 2003 paper, and it's on quantitative traits, again, parametric. So we want the model, right? So it's very simple, really. It's really not that hard. So what I'm going to do, however, I'm going to switch things on you because I think it's easier to sort of stay with quantitative trait, okay, and cross-sectional sample. I'll show you, and hopefully you will believe me, that it's only a matter of changing the likelihood at the end. So if you want some other scenario. But this is kind of straightforward for exposition and some computations too. So YI, the phenotype is normal for ith individual, has mean mu I, and this is the precision for that phenotype, tau p. And there is a linear model here. These are genetic effects. And this is some environmental or other covariates that you may have. Okay? Now, of course, this morning we heard a talk by Brahmar just on how to combine these and what the inference problems are there in identifying interaction between genetic and environmental effects. But we're not doing that, or at least not yet, along with all the other things. So now what is the genotype thing? So these are the variables. This is L equal to 1 to cap C. That cap C is the number of candidate markers that we have, that we're interested in. And then C plus 1 through L are going, capital L, are going to be all the null markers. And at each one, we have these two variables. WIL is an indicator of this heterozygous, and V is cap A, cap A indicator, okay? So that's what we use. This is really not exactly what people in genetics use, but it's just the transformation, so we can recover whatever they want. And now, for the genetic marker part, so these are all the loci. Oh, this time it's L plus C, okay, fine. So notational, maybe not quite consistent. All right, so this is fairly easy. We're just going to the logits here. And then what all of this is, on the previous overhead, I should have mentioned this. I left this beta 0 I as a random effect, OK? Because one of the main reasons you want to do this is that the different subpopulations have different levels, average levels, different blood pressure averages, OK? So you need to allow for that and model it that way. So that is, whereas the genetic effects are not. This is data, but that should be a 1 and not an I. So this is beta 1L and beta 2L. So those are fixed. They are locus dependent, but not person dependent. So that I is a misprint, this one. But this I is not a misprint. That's intended to be there. Okay, and so we're going to collect all of these, this locus information, and then the parameters that go with it, and then this beta 0 I, and we're going to have a big dimensional Dirichlet process here, and just, so these will be normals. So it's very simple, straightforward, right? Well, this is a model graph. So the thetas are at the candidate loci as well as at the null markers, and they generate the W's, and all of these here are modeled with a big Dirichlet process, and then there are these beta 0 here depends on I, and these don't, and that all generates your Y. Okay, so that's a straightforward model. Simulation methods. Well, I think many people have mentioned lots of different simulation methods, and here's an overhead that lists most of the popular ones and the original ones. And I think this kind of overhead has been there in many talks that so far, and will be the rest of the week. So we use Jain's algorithm. Neil's algorithm, not Jain and Neil, but Neil's algorithm from 2000, algorithm 5 in particular. And it seems to work very well for our purposes. I don't think I'll go over that algorithm per se, but there are then other things to update, which are the betas, and that's a conjugate normal update, and then the thetas. We need to use adaptive rejection sampling to do that, but it's really not difficult. So simulation is fairly straightforward, the posterior simulation. So then, that's just completing. Oh, and there is this, the phenotypic precision needs to be estimated also. So there is that parameter. Priors that we used were, I don't know. I don't want to give it a name like vague or non-informative or anything like that, but just practically flat, okay? I'll just say it that way. Now, I want to show you now some simulation scenario, several of them actually, but that we began with. So 400 subjects at 500 markers, okay? Seems to be like studies are of this magnitude often. They're getting much more, though, in the number of markers, but perhaps not in the number of subjects as rapidly increasing. Then we started out with two populations, and we gave one population an FST of 0.01 and 0.035. Once again, these are numbers that sort of come from the genetics literature, that these are reasonable numbers to use. Okay? And we simulated allele frequencies, these 500 markers. And of course, they come out different. And the biggest difference was 0.355, and the smallest difference was 0, up to 3 decimal places. So now we're going to apply the algorithm. So first I'm going to show you that clustering happens sort of reasonably well. Okay? So I'm going to focus on the clustering, not the phenotype yet and not the betas yet. So that's what I called estimation. This is all done in one step, of course. We're just one single model. So this is the prior. Maybe I should apologize for that, but alpha is fixed at 1. Okay, and so this is the prior. You can, there it is. I think you can read the numbers down at the bottom, right? 6, 7, 8, somewhere there is the mode, goes up to 15 or so. And this is the posterior. So this is right at 2. So it's kind of collapses easily. Okay, but of course, I think we have a lot of information. 500 markers, 400 people. So I think that's maybe is the reason. But you will see that it's not always the case. Oh, by the way, these are the frequencies. The two that I showed you were the farthest apart. Well, it's very clear. And this is what the zero was. So at that locus, we got this predictive density. So that makes sense. And this was the in-between one. This is not so far apart, these two. 0.6 and 0.74 about. And that's also fairly well detected with this kind of sample size. So just to give you some benchmark for sort of having what it might take in the sample sizes, et cetera. So then we said, okay, well, let's do a four population scenario. Maybe this two case was really too simple, and so we just made some case here. Really not that important, but here I sort of high heterogeneity. We picked these numbers in such a way that there is a fair amount of heterogeneity here. And so we did the same thing. Not the same prior, because the sample size, we bumped that up to 800 instead of the 400, okay? And so this is the posterior. Now you can see that the posterior, if you just look at this, 5 is the mode by far, and 4 are the number of populations. But if you go look in the MCMC output, it's very clear that the fifth largest cluster is invariably of size 2 or 3 or 1. So it's kind of irrelevant, you see? So it's not enough to just say, oh, what's the posterior distribution for the number of clusters? Because that's not relevant to us. If we miss out on, or we add a cluster that's that small, it's really not going to hopefully hurt the estimation of betas too badly. Okay? So, but that is the case.
Prakash, yeah. Do you actually assume marker independence? Or yes. Do you allow for LD? Because you have 500.
I have not allowed for LD.
A fair amount of LD also, I think.
Yes, yes. That is the next step, right. We have not done that yet, right? But we, I think, have a plan. We know how to go about it, so.
Yeah. So in your simulation, the 1,000 markers, are all of them null markers, and you have only one
candidate? No.
Or how did you divide the?
Oh, this was, let's see, how, where
so
is it?
So you said 800 subjects and 1,000
markers. 1,000 markers. There were 5 candidates in there. Okay, I'll show you more complete things in a minute or two. So that's the story here. Okay, but then these pictures are similar. They cluster nicely. This is a low heterogeneity scenario. Actually, this overhead has wrong numbers on it. I think I should say that for the purpose of the recording that's going on. I think this is repeated from the previous one. But anyway, the real numbers were different from this, and this reflects the case of low heterogeneity. Okay, the numbers are set to not make the population so very different from each other. And in this case, you see there is a huge spike at 3, but there were 4 populations. And this time, this is the size of the fourth cluster is not small. So it did really get fooled. Okay, so there were 4 clusters at times, reasonably sized, but many times there were only 3 clusters. So with low heterogeneity, it found only mainly 3 clusters. Okay, now, with low heterogeneity, once again, our hope, and maybe we can show this somehow, is that if the heterogeneity is low, you don't have as much of a problem in estimating the betas, and you'll probably get away with it. Because this is properly Bayesianly integrating out that uncertainty. Otherwise, you couldn't get away with it. So that's what I mean by get away with it. So but that's, again, I don't have convincing data to show you that. so now the trait simulation. So this is about clustering story, right? But what we're really interested in is how did we simulate that? Well, we took, sort of had blood pressure numbers in mind. So I don't know, just picked 100 and 120. As the mean levels for the two subpopulations, and then 750 markers, including 5 candidates. This is what the simulation was, And there are three scenarios. One is sample size 700. Another is 1,000, just to see if it does better. And then what we did was we went back to these 700, same 700, and then added 300 admixed individuals instead of the purely coming from the ancestral populations, okay? Just to see what happens when you throw in admixed people in there. And for the simulation scenarios, the betas were chosen out of the five. These three loci, the number three and number five, really wasn't, were zeros, okay? So they were not associated in the simulation. And then this here had a large kappa effect. And this one, not so large. And this had both little a kappa and kappa. And for those of you who may be familiar with this additive and dominance effect, they just translate like that. So and the standard deviation was 10. So the precision tau, oh, there it is, 0.01. So the measurement standard error on the phenotype was 10. OK? So that's the scenario. And the admixed ancestry, the way we generate it is we simulate this Q for each individual. Basically, this was one, so it's a flat on the simplex, and then generate that, and then generate, of course, with those proportions, the alleles at each site. So it's fairly straightforward how to do that. So now I wanted to show, this is not Bayesian now. This is just straight. But this is really naive analysis. It's not proper frequentist analysis either. It's just totally ignoring structure and just doing regression fit, okay? Just estimating what these are. And you can see that this is just way off, just about everywhere. And these chi-squares are kind of quite... Now, this chi-square is large, but if you look at the estimate, you can see that that is only because this number is 2.7 and minus 4.8, right? And then it's a very high positive correlation, and that just makes the distance from the null fairly large, but it's meaningless. The estimates are just totally wrong, and also in many other places. And there is something spurious going on here. So that's easy to do. That's easy to make up a case where those naive things will go bad. Now, with 700 people, we did very well. As you can see, just about every one of these credible intervals. And by the way, these are simultaneous. So there are 10 of these. So we made a, you know, they're wide enough. They adjust for, but from the MCMC samples. So they include the correlations in them automatically. And so these are, and this chi-square is just the distance measured in, measured in terms of the covariance matrix, posterior covariance matrix of the samples. Okay? That's what we use to get this chi-square, distance from zero. So scenario two, I'm not going to be able to compare this for you very well. So, but basically, as you increase the sample size, you get better estimates. Not tremendously better. You're going only from 700 to 1,000. But you improve that. And then when you put in the admixed individuals, it goes bad again. Okay, so the admixed individual scenario creates some trouble. Many of these go away. And see, this is not, you couldn't detect this. And actually, technically, not even that one, although it's a very almost on the edge. So you could possibly conclude that. But if you look at the sizes of these, they're not quite as nice as they were without the admixed individuals. Okay, so admixed individuals do cause a problem. Now, what so far we just threw them in, right, into the same algorithm that really is designed for structure only and not admixture. So we would like to fix that. And rather than describe all of this, basically I'll point out now that we are going to act like we know who the admixed people are, okay, for the moment. So if you know who the admixed people are, and or at least say high admixture people are and the low admixture people, can separate them out in your data, then you could write separate likelihoods for them. Okay, and that's the approach that we have taken here. And basically, if I'll focus it here, see, in Pritchard's case, he's got fixed K and it's parametric. So he's got identified clusters, right? So he can talk about one means one, two means two. In the Dirichlet clustering, you don't have that. You don't have the labeling. So that does cause a bit of a problem. But then what we do is we effectively write this likelihood in terms of each non or low admixed individual. Each high admixture individual has a piece of the low admixed individual. But the low admixed individuals are clustered, see? So you're going to get the same information projected back in. So that way, the clustering, even though there isn't any labeling, you think of it as though you would do it person by person, and then you write the likelihood down, you go back into the algorithm, and you see it's just like putting them together. So it sort of goes away. That problem of labeling goes away. That's essentially what it is. So, and then now, of course, we need some additional priors. So we need the admixture mix. These Qs are there in this model now. I should have pointed that out. The Qs come right here. Okay, and this is written in terms of logit, so it looks like that. But this is the piece of the ith individual that the ith high admixture individual has with jth low admixture individual. Okay? And that's the Q. So the Q is sort of dimension-wise, see, it goes all the way over all of that's not correct. That should be L. I goes from 1 through NH. That's right. But this alpha, the dimension for this, is N sub L. Okay? Because the low admix, so you're admixing the low individuals to get the high admixture individuals. Okay? So this vector is a little long. Depends on the sample size. Not just the cluster size. Okay. And then this is and then you need a prior that they match the ith and the jth, and that's simply 1 over ML. So, there's a model picture, but I'm not so sure that it's that much different, and this is only for the high admixed individuals. The Y is shown here, and not for the low, because that's the same model as before. It's just this part changes, and what goes into it changes through the Qs here. Okay. Now, with the hybrid model scenario, we were able to improve these estimates. So I'll show you maybe I think there is a comparative slide here, but they improve slightly. It's not a great improvement, but there is some improvement. Maybe it's more apparent here. So last two columns. This was 3 that had the admixed people, but they were all put into that model that didn't even know there was admixture present, okay? And this third one is a model built for admixture, but you have to know which people are highly admixed. And if you do that, then you have some improvement here. This is 10, so things go in the correct direction, but the improvement is not dramatic, okay? But the improvement is there sufficiently to not throw it away. I mean, it's worth doing and it's not that much more complicated model, really. So then the next question that we were trying to address was how should we detect these admixed individuals? Because we don't know. I mean, maybe perhaps there are some other methods by which you could do it which have nothing to do with this, you know, statistical method. But we thought that there should be a statistical method of perhaps somehow pre-processing the data and then coming up with who is admixed and who is not admixed, okay? So here's what we thought of. We thought, okay, so in the algorithm, as the Gibbs chain is running, there are people that are put into various clusters, okay? And we thought that the admixed people would be bouncing around the clusters more, okay? Now, but the clusters are not labeled, so you can't really keep track of it that way, okay? So the way we tried to do it was we used, now this is very crude and it's not giving great results yet, so we're still working on this to see how we can improve this. But these are two successive Gibbs iterations, right? And we're going to look at the entire vector of estimated allele frequencies at that time, right? Estimated only from the cluster in which this individual is. Okay? And then, so if they're moving from one cluster to another of a different frequency structure, then you're going to see differences here. That was the idea. Okay? And so the bigger this number is, the more highly admixed that person seems to be. Okay? So, And it seemed like a simple thing to do with the chain. We already have models. Everything is already there. And this is what happened. I hope you can see the dots. It's not that much meaning to them. But on this horizontal axis is, these are only two populations, and they're the Qs. Okay? So they're saying, what is it that you're going from 0 to 1? So we randomly picked the admixture level, and then we admixed them. And you can see that they're not at 0.1 to 0.9. They were restricted away from 1 and 0. And so these here are the low admixture people. These right here at 0 and 1. And these in here are admixed people. The ones in here are the very highly admixed, okay, etc. And you sort of get a cloud, it's not quite a cloud. We would have liked a cloud of points up there, but you basically get like a little plume or something. And so you pick up some, but you see there are all of these down here. They're also admixed, and they were not picked up. Now, so we thought, okay, well, let's do something like an ROC curve here. And you can see that it does very nicely right at the beginning, you know, but you don't have to lose any of these people, okay? You pretty much have perfect on those, and you pick up about 30-32% of the admixed people. But after that, it's not doing so well. So, of course, we would have liked this to be way up there and like that. So, so this is perhaps not the best way to go about it, but we're still working on that. Okay, so now, what are the other things that we have in store? Well, binary outcomes. Binary outcomes, if you're still cross-sectional, is very simple. You just replace that normal linear regression with a logistic regression, and that's it. Okay? And actually, case control studies aren't that difficult either. We've seen now retrospective likelihoods that are used very successfully in modeling this. Now, Brahmar made a case this morning that even that aspect of it should not be parametric, but perhaps should have a non-parametric structure on the environmental variables. So, but that is that could certainly be handled. These are the two papers that at least we are relying on for the likelihood. And then come some of the extensions. So. We have clustered just by the entire, all of the markers, and that's really ignoring a lot of genetic information. So we probably want to get away from that and do, but once again, I think the model is simple enough and straightforward enough to implement that these extensions should be doable. introducing dependent structure, this is the linkage disequilibrium patterns that are often known, or a lot is known about them, and then you could use that in this. So then you need dependent structure among neighboring loci, and there is some recent work by Peter Hoff that has dependent binary sequences, and perhaps that would be useful here to in this effort. And then some of the people at the medical college, they're sort of interested in, they're often in a situation where they really don't know that they have good null markers. So they're suspicious of saying that something is a null marker, especially when they're looking at complicated diseases like high blood pressure or diabetes and so on. So they have they're sort of reluctant to do that, and so they were saying, well, if you can come up with a method that can identify for us what are good null markers to use in studies, we would like that. So first, when we got into it, I thought, oh well, the geneticists know what the null markers are and what their candidate loci are. Well, it's not often the case. They don't know. They're just looking. And they would like some guidance in establishing what are good null markers. So if we can do it, this would be a nice thing to do too. Oh, references are in a separate file. I think that's all I have to say.
We have time for some questions.
Crystal clear, right? But I have questions, so I see many people in this audience that know a lot more about genetics, and anything you can share with me in terms of where we're going with this over a beer or a gin or something like that would be just fine.
I have a question. So the latest kind of genotyping chips, and we're moving into 1 million markers. Mm-hmm. How scalable is the?
We have done thousands. Yeah, we can get to thousands, and we haven't really tried very hard to go any farther. And I mean, our computing machinery is not state of the art where I am, and it's I think it may be because the clustering is nice. It just the Dirichlet stuff is fairly robust to the dimensionality there. But we don't know. We're hoping that things will work there.
Okay, so the second practice again.
Yep.